Welcome to the Think Christianly podcast, where we help Christians understand what they believe, why they believe it, and why it matters. And now your host, author and speaker, Jonathan Morrow.
All right, well, welcome to this episode of the Think Christianly podcast, and we're going to explore the question, is the Bible full of contradictions? That is a common claim being made today, and so we're going to explore that with one of the leading New Testament scholars of our day, which I'm so thrilled with, to have Dr. Daryl Bach with us. Now, Daryl Bach is the Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Howard G. Hendricks Center for Christian Leadership, and he is also the Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. He's earned international recognition as a Humboldt Scholar through Tübingen in Germany, and his work on Luke Acts, which is phenomenal, commentaries. He's been past president of the Evangelical Theological Society, published over 30 books. He's a New York Times bestselling author, does a lot of work with media, ABC, CNN, all those kind of outlets, and really engages well. And personally, I had the privilege of taking classes from Dr. Bach while I was at Dallas Seminary and learned so much from him in his classes, not only on the historical Jesus, but also on the tone with which he engages these questions. And that's probably more than anything marks the way that I try to approach things, is just kind of watching the way that he engages well. And so, Daryl, it's so great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us.
My pleasure.
So the question about Jesus in the Bible has changed in pop culture. How has that shifted over the years? You've kind of talked about this, but even with the rise of the Da Vinci Code and things like that, how do Christians need to think about how this conversation is happening now?
Well, it used to be that there was a great deal of respect for the Bible. You could talk about Jesus, go directly to the Bible and have it be taken it for granted that you could trust the Bible, certainly the gist of the story in Scripture. That has definitely changed. The Bible is now no longer the answer. It's the question in many cases. And so one's ability to appeal directly to the text for what's going on with Jesus is diminished. And it requires an additional level of conversation to defend or justify the appeal to the text. It also requires some explanation for some of the issues that people bring up that they see as problematic. And, of course, what we're getting ready to discuss, you know, how to put the various accounts of the same event next to one another is one of these aspects. It means that the person who engages on Jesus is going to have to be prepared for a person who has heard you can't trust the Bible, or the Bible's full of myths, or there are different gospels saying very different things that actually compete with one another, those kinds of things, before they engage the details of the text. And that, it just makes the process more complicated.
Right. And you've also talked, too, about how the conversation not only is happening in academic journals, but now, I mean, we're rolling into Christmas time, right? And so the Discovery Channel, History Channel is just going to be full of specials talking about these things, quite frankly, at a level of sophistication that most Christians have never engaged, and it's kind of disconcerting to them, right?
That's correct. I mean, the whole niche capability that we have in our communications with documentaries, with focused, you know, History Channel, Discovery Channel, National Geographic, you know, all these different channels that concentrate on history, particularly at Christmas and Easter, zero in on talking about issues in the Bible. And usually the form of those stories goes, you have heard it said from long ago, X, but today we know Y. And and so that difference means that the people's faith and the way they view the faith is often challenged in these shows and in ways that most Christians are not aware of. So there's that dimension of the equation as well. In fact, that dimension's probably contributed to the way in which the culture sees these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we talk about, you know, let's just envision a student. So today we have a great opportunity because we have a leading New Testament scholar to help us with this. But imagine you're the freshman at college. You sit down in your Bible as literature class. And then say a quote like this. This is from Bart Ehrman, shows up from his book, Jesus Interrupted, where he makes a claim like this: a Christianity dependent on the inerrancy of the Bible probably cannot survive the reality of the discrepancies. And that's at the end of his chapter called A World of Contradictions, in which he just begins to go point by point through all these things. And there's that student, and perhaps they've never heard anything about this. And so before we get into some of the more of the details, how would you advise them to process that, this question of, okay, is the Bible full of contradictions, both intellectually and emotionally, I guess, for the first time once they're confronted with some of these challenges?
Well, I think the key thing here is to just understand how the material is being pitted against itself. That both readings are assuming that the way these events should be told is almost in an exact replication with one another rather than having differences. I tell people that if you ask my wife to describe our courtship and what drew her to me, and you ask me the same question, you get very different details. And if I push those details like a defense lawyer might, you might come to the view there's no way to put these stories together. There's no way they can be talking about the same event. But if you allow them to complement one another and come alongside one another as two accounts taken from two slightly different angles, then you're much less likely to have a problem. So I think that's one aspect of it. I think the other aspect of it is that we need to realize that this conversation takes place on a spectrum. And that spectrum goes all the way from the Bible is inerrant, and then there's what people mean by inerrancy. Is it, and this is why the precision and accuracy discussion is so important. All and the people who are putting the contradictions against one another want precision, but not necessarily accuracy. And we'll sort that out in just a minute. All the way over to the people who think, you know, a lot of it's made up. Well, there are possibilities in the middle that still leave you trusting the account and sorting your way through the account, sifting the account, if you will, without dismissing the whole thing, and still leaves all the major questions that the Bible puts forward on the table. That's a whole nother place to land, if you will. And I tell college students that if you're talking to someone who's read Ehrman or whatever, and the attitude is, well, you can't trust the Bible at all, try this. Try and get them to say, well, let's assume the core of the story is correct. Maybe we can debate a few details here and there, but let's assume that the core of the story is correct, and let's talk about what the core of the story is. And oftentimes, if you can get there, you can actually get to all the conversations you want to have. And then I find the closer people get to understanding the Jesus of the Bible and the way Jesus works with the Bible, the more they're drawn into taking the Bible more seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in essence, kind of going from a step of, okay, is this even historically accessible to us, the words and sayings of Jesus and who this person was, Jesus of Nazareth? And then we can deal with a further question of inerrancy. I remember you like to say, everybody's got an inerrancy list where they can just keep bringing up these issues, and then you never get to Jesus. You never get to the Bible in the sense of the core claims being made there. And sometimes I feel like Christians feel like they have to get the whole ball of wax in one conversation. And so what I hear you saying is, well, let's take our time with this. If somebody's coming from a skeptical position, or even if you're a skeptic yourself trying to wrestle through this, you can get to a historical core, and that gets to one of the questions I want to ask about, which is this idea of how reliable is the oral tradition, the story form that was talked about, and I guess, you know, so can we trust that historical core from that standpoint?
Yeah, I think the oral tradition is solid. I mean, I think the line of communication for it is solid. I think you had apostolic oversight. I think you had a culture that was used to oral communication. If we assume, let's assume for the sake of discussion, that what we have written down in the Gospels, even with the variations that we have in them about the same stories, is a reflection of what oral communication looks like, what you get is a core gist of the story that is very consistent from version to version and differences in details. Now the question becomes, in a discussion with a skeptic, is the variation in the details enough to discount the whole, or is the variation in the details should simply be seen as variation in the details? And, you know, that's a discussion you can have. But I think what you see in the oral tradition is the core of the story is right. I like to tell story this way. I'm meeting with a group of students, 12 students, and they go out and tell students who weren't in the class what the class is about and what I said. There would probably be differences in details about what got brought up, but hopefully the emphasis that would come out of that class, let's say it's a historical Jesus class, would be a pretty consistent testimony about the fact that I, you know, present the historical Jesus as connected to the Christ of faith, make a point about how historical this material, you know, the core ideas would be right. They would agree on those things. Another example that I like to use with oral communication, just to get people to think about it, is this. You know, we don't live in an oral culture. We live in a written culture, in a digital culture, in a recording culture. We're used to having things remembered for us. Ancient world, they had to remember things orally, and they had to remember it for themselves. And that becomes a very important part of the process. Now, the closest thing to living in an oral world that we have in our world are kids who haven't learned to read and write yet. My grandchildren, for example. I've got Aiden, who's now is reading, and Toby, 7 and 5. But there was a time when I would tell them stories. They were they were 3 and 5. They weren't reading yet. And certain stories I would tell them again and again and again and again because we'd be reading the books to them. I used to do this with my kids as well. Well, if I change that story, if I change the rhyme or put something in that wasn't in there before, you know what they would say to me? They would say, "Opa, that's not how it goes." And they would correct me. So for retold events, which is what gospel stories would be, that are told again and again and again and that are held in corporate memory, not just in the memory of one person, but in the memory of several people with some oversight, your tradition is going to be fairly strong and it's going to be very good in the core details. And that's what I think the oral tradition brings us.
Right. And so I hear what you're saying there is the sense of we need to read the text in light of maybe the way they use history in the first century rather than this idea in the 21st century where we come at it, we're a very soundbite, slogan, kind of gotcha culture, even the way the news is. You get these 8-second quotes and they get pitted against one another and everything else. And when you come with that mindset to the New Testament world, that's not going to work out as well, but it's also illegitimate. So you wouldn't say it's special pleading to say, actually, you know what, the historical, we need to look at these things differently, right?
That's right. And the other thing to realize is there are ways to tell stories. I can quote, I can summarize, I can paraphrase. All of these can be accurate, even though one form of it might be more precise than the other. And so when we pit versions against one another and try and make them precise against one another, then that's a problem. When we allow for the kinds of variations in which stories can be told orally and then think through what those relationships might be in a complementary way, then we can begin to see how I think the material actually operates in an oral culture.
Yeah, and this was the distinction that you wrote so helpfully about and you contributed to the book, Do Historical Matters Matter to Faith, which I'm going to have links at thinkchristianly.org for readers to find more about you and your books and this article that you wrote in there about precision and accuracy. And you've kind of mentioned it, but maybe let's introduce those concepts of precision and accuracy. And then how do those help us maybe looking through some of the specific things, like some of the accounts, maybe kind of walk us through maybe an example or two of how that helps us in our understanding of passages that may at first glance seem like, you know, are these talking about the same thing?
Well, precision means exactly what it says. It's a very precise, as close to the detailed facts, no approximation, no paraphrase, you know, quotation. Precision means what it means. It's a very focused way of presenting material. Accuracy is a broader concept, and I can be accurate without being precise. I can say, you know, Jesus went there after about 8 days rather than saying he went there after 6 days. And it's different, both accurate, but accurate in a different way. I can approximate a crowd. There were about 5,000 out there as opposed to 4,223. One's precise and the other is more accurate. And so we get these differences related to precision and accuracy running through the text in a variety of ways. It even relates to the way Jesus is quoted when he's speaking. Sometimes we get precise words. The technical term for this is ipsissima verba, the very words of Jesus, or sometimes we get his what he said summarized or paraphrased. That's the ipsissima vox. We get the voice of Jesus, but we may not have his exact words. It can be accurate, but it's not as precise. So when you get one account that's precise and the other one that is accurate, that's not as precise but still gives you the core point, you can pit these things against one another. And if you pit them together at the level of precision, one of the accounts will look out of whack. If you recognize the distinction, you'll appreciate what's going on, that the author, that one author has chosen to give more detail than the other, either because they knew it or they didn't. You know, that explains why they express it the way that they do, and it produces the difference.
Yeah, and that's very helpful. And so maybe applying this, you do a great job of applying this in a clear way to the occurrence of the healing of the centurion's son. Matthew talks about this and others, but can you kind of talk through kind of how what looks like at first glance might be contradictory accounts, using your categories can really help us really get a three-dimensional sense of what's going on there instead of this flat, two-dimensional kind of wooden reading that sometimes happens there.
Well, in the healing of the centurion's son, in the Matthean version, the centurion and Jesus have a direct conversation with one another. And so if you just had Matthew, you would think the centurion walked up to Jesus, asked for the healing. When he couldn't come, when he saw that Jesus was going to heal his servant, he simply said, "You can do this from a distance, speak the word, and it'll be done." And you have that account by itself, and that's what it looks like. If you go to the Lucan parallel, and it's clearly the same event, this is Matthew 8, 5 to 13, and Luke 7, 1 to 10. It's clearly the same event. It's located in virtually the same location in the two Gospels, right after the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain. All the details of the story in terms of the healing and the circumstances pretty much match. Well, in Luke, you've got Jewish emissaries who come out and interact with Jesus. The centurion himself does not participate directly in a conversation. The Jewish emissaries represent the centurion to Jesus and for Jesus. They're his spokespeople. So these are, you know, very clearly different details. Everything else about the healing is the same. I said the core, the gist of what happened here, that this centurion's son was healed, that there was a declaration by the centurion that I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. All you have to do is speak first. That's all communicated in both accounts, one of them through emissaries and the other directly by the centurion himself. And so you sit back and you say, well, the Lucan version appears to be the more precise account. We get the emissaries directly. We know who all the players are in the conversation. Matthew has simplified the account. It's still accurate because the emissaries are representing the centurion in their communication. They're communicating what he desires. They're communicating why he thinks Jesus doesn't actually need to come to his house to perform the healing. That's all coming from the centurion, but it's coming from the centurion through the emissaries in Luke. It's coming directly from the centurion in Matthew. So the Matthean account is abbreviated, it's simplified, and it is accurate, even though it's not as precise as the Lucan account. And that's an application of the distinction.
That's great. And it also reminds us that you often talked about not wanting to make gospel stew in recognizing that Matthew has a distinct purpose in his gospel, you know, that there's a distinct, you know, author who's trying to accomplish something different than, say, what Luke was trying to accomplish in the way that he ordered and arranged and even talked about details, right? That's something that
Yeah, and there's stylistic things going on, too. So Luke has a concern to communicate in the midst of his gospel the way in which Jews and Gentiles are able to be reconciled to one another and can be part of the same community. And so we get in the centurion story these Jewish emissaries who are sensitive in their relationship with the centurion are representing him and show the possibilities for reconciliation that can exist. Matthew isn't interested in that theme, so he doesn't have it. The other thing that's important here is that Matthew stylistically tends to simplify his stories. This is one place of many where the Matthean version of the parallel is a simplified, abbreviated version of something we have in more detail either in Luke or in Mark. And so this is a stylistic feature of Matthew's own writing that we see as well, to keep the story as simple as possible. You put those two things together and you generate your explanation for why you have the differences that you do. And you don't have a contradiction in the story. You have the same story. You just have one person giving you more detail than the other.
That's very helpful. I think just even thinking in those categories will help us come to really a fuller and richer understanding of what it is that's actually going on in these Gospels as biographies, that early genre going on there. What about the occurrence, maybe another example, the baptism of Jesus? Sometimes that's brought up, that what's actually going on there, who's talking and to who, and help us with that passage a little bit.
Well, and again, with the baptism of Jesus, this is one that that has generated an impression on the one hand versus what's really going on. So there are two things going on. This is basically a private experience between Jesus and the voice from heaven, with perhaps John the Baptist being aware of what's going on. The paintings that you see in art galleries literally around the world of this scene, where, you know, everyone's kind of observing what's going on, seeing the Spirit descend on Jesus, etc., that's probably not what's happened. And if you read the Markan account very carefully, you will see that the voice speaks directly to Jesus, and that this is primarily portrayed as a fundamentally private experience. But what's interesting is what the voice says. In two of the versions, in Luke and Mark, he says, "You are my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." In the version in Matthew, it goes, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." So in one, we get the direct address to Jesus, actually reflecting the fact that we've got a private experience, where we have a more generalized expression in Matthew. Now, what's going on here? Here, I think what's happening is that Matthew is giving the significance of what this address is, and so he's paraphrasing the voice to show there was a presentation of Jesus, or at least an affirmation and confirmation of who Jesus was, by the voice in heaven, which, if you appreciate, has happened, is significant for everybody. So the "you" becomes a "this" in making that move. Now, we know John the Baptist saw what took place, because in the Gospel of John, he testifies to the fact that the one on whom he saw the Spirit descending, that's the one who was the Christ. So we know John saw it. We know this was a general historical event that at least someone else witnessed besides Jesus. And that becomes the justification for being able to talk about, "This is my son." So in the two versions, we get what I think is the accurate version of what was said: "You are my beloved son." But in Matthew, we get it presented in terms of its historical significance and what it means for anyone who may have heard what took place, or anyone who's aware of what was said that took place. And then it becomes, "This is my beloved son," because it's a presentation of Jesus.
That's so helpful to think through those categories and those terms. Another one that's often brought up, maybe take one more of these, is Peter's confession. This idea of what's going on, and okay, what was the actual situation? What did Peter say or didn't say? And what was Jesus' response? Kind of what's going on in the different aspects going on in that event?
Well, again, this is another one where the issue has to do with what's said. In Mark, we have, "You are the Christ." In Luke, we have, "You are the Christ of God." And in Matthew, we have, "You are the Christ," and then I like to do this with a voice, "the Son of the Living God." Okay, we have an addition here at the end, which, of course, most readers read in a kind of fullness in terms of what "Son of God" means. And certainly, since this is a voice from heaven, it could mean all that. But what's interesting is, when we compare the parallels to one another, if we ask what the core of the gist of the confession is from Peter, it's the idea of "You are the Christ." Peter is not reflecting a heavenly point of view yet completely. He is simply reflecting on the recognition that Jesus is the Christ, in contrast to the populace, which sees Jesus as a prophet. So the emphasis in the passage is the recognition that God is at the center, the unique figure at the center of God's unique salvation program, as opposed to a declaration of full ontology. He is the Messiah. That's what Matthew, Mark, and Luke share. The new element in Matthew is the Son of God element, which can develop into a full understanding. And in fact, I think that's part of what Matthew's gospel is about, is to show you where Son of God is eventually going to take you. But Peter doesn't necessarily have that all that understanding when he makes that confession at Caesarea Philippi. And then when Jesus says, I can build upon this, you know, he uses the image of the rock. What Jesus is saying is, if you recognize that I'm at the center of God's salvation program and that I am his anointed one sent to bring this program, I can work with you. You know, that's a point from which you can launch and get to everywhere that we need to get to. Whereas if you're like the crowd and you just think Jesus is one of the prophets, I mean, you've given Jesus a value, but it isn't valuable enough. It doesn't take you to all the places that Jesus' ministry is going to take you. So that's the point of the passage, and that's the emphasis of the passage, and that's why you get the differences that you do in the.
Yeah, that's great. And those categories of precision and accuracy really, really help us get a richer understanding. So that's super helpful as we think through those categories. You know, around Christmas time, people, again, engage the birth accounts of Jesus. And so one of the questions that's often asked is, okay, well, what about Luke and what's going on there with the census? And is that accurate? And kind of what's going on? I know you've written a lot on, obviously, Luke, Acts, and that's one of your specialties. So can you help us kind of navigate some of those issues around that passage?
Yeah, in fact, Bart Ehrman did an article in this last week for the digital version of Newsweek. I think it's called The Daily Beast. Mm-hmm. And in it, he goes through several points of the infancy story that he thinks has problems, and the census is one of them. And it is true that the census is one of the most difficult issues in Luke's gospel. And that's because we have the parallel in Josephus, and the parallel in Josephus dates the census to AD 6. To the time when Quirinius was governor that we know about, and he also indicates that this was an unprecedented tax. In fact, it was so unprecedented that it produced a political reaction from Jews at the time. So it doesn't fit the birth date time of Jesus. Jesus' birth is put at about 4 BC because it's connected to a time near the death of Herod the Great. So we've got this discrepancy that's there in our historical record. Well, what I've argued is that we shouldn't think of tax collection in the first century as a process that's as instantaneous as the world of the internet, and that what we have is a slow process that takes a bit of time to do the registration, to put the administrative elements in place, et cetera. So we might have worked towards the census and then eventually accomplished it after a period of time. So my sense would be that what we're dealing with here is a process that started with the registrations and that got organized for doing the tax, and then eventually the tax was levied and collected. And that process took place over a longer period of time. That's one way to handle it. Another way some people handle it is to handle it grammatically in the language of in the way Luke writes, and to say something to the effect that the census took place before Quirinius was governor, and to not tie the census specifically to Quirinius. My own sense is that the census may have been tied to Quirinius because he's the one who actually ended up implementing it and collecting the tax. That at least an explanation for what we have going on here. As I said, this is one of the more difficult problems that we do face in Luke Acts in relationship to these events because of what Josephus has to say about it. But my own explanation is that the process just took time to execute.
Right. So in essence, you have somebody like Ehrman claiming, well, look, tax day is April 15th, and if it didn't occur on that date, and then you take that standard and read it back into the first century where a process is not allowed for, then of course you're going to generate a contradiction.
Or another perhaps better example is, you know, we have a lot of talk about Obamacare, but the time between the time when the legislation's passed and you actually choose to implement it and begin paying out on it, there's a time lag. And then put ourselves in a world that's not as instantaneously set up as ours is, and it just takes time to administer it all.
Yeah, that's very helpful, because context really does matter, and so we need to be careful not to read back into the text assumptions and details that just wouldn't be present in their minds or in their cultural experience.
That's right.
So that's great. Well, so you've already talked about the idea of kind of helping the skeptic or the seeker or the college freshman who's exploring these things. Okay, can we at least get to historical reliability? But oftentimes when I interact with Christians, how does what we're talking about here, which is probably a little more sophisticated than what gets talked about on the typical Sunday morning in a sermon or when these passages are dealt with, how do we help Christians understand how even sources and the idea of oral tradition and all this stuff fits in with the doctrine of inspiration and even inerrancy? So maybe helping the Christian specifically here, maybe even define those terms a little bit and just kind of give them a little kind of 101 lesson on how do we understand this in light of kind of the complexities of what we talked about today.
Well, the main thing is to have context where people can interact on it and ask questions. So the settings in which you talk about this are settings like a home Bible study or in certain private conversations, that kind of thing, where you can interact and you can help people get located culturally and socially with what the practices are and how they work. That's the practical side of it. And then it's just giving time over to this, helping people understand the first century is not the 21st century. People didn't live the same way. They didn't do the same kinds of things. They didn't tell stories in the same way with the same kinds of expectations, that kind of thing. And just getting these accounts placed in a larger context. You know, another interesting thing about the ancient world is they valued the living voice over the written word, generally speaking. There's a very famous citation in which Papias is talking about the traditions of when the Gospels are written and how he found out about Jesus. And he makes a point that he appreciated hearing from the living word. In fact, he preferred hearing from a living word rather than words written down on a page. And so, and I paraphrase that, by the way. And so that's the attitude of the ancient world, was that oral testimony given by a live person was more valuable than anything that was written down and recorded. Well, that's a cultural attitude that may not be shared with everyone. Everyone thinking the same way today. It's different than the way things are thought about today. Helping people appreciate that, and then the different dynamics that generates helps get to this. So you just have to encourage people to dig deeper, and then you have to provide the time and the detail to help people get there.
That's very helpful. And then just helping people see that, you know, the idea of inspiration is a very fully human and fully divine process. And sometimes we forget the fully human process where people actually interviewed people and wrote things down and talked about them in communities,
yeah,
and things like that.
Luke even talks about in Luke 1 and 2 that he had access to sources, and that verse 3 talks about having checked everything carefully. So he went through a very, as you said, human process in putting this together. He didn't sit down, plug in his Skype and say, okay, God, tell me what to write for the Gospel of Luke.
And that would, in some ways, that would have been easier. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's helpful to see the richness, and it has the ring of authenticity to it. This idea that, you know, you've talked about this when looking at some of the so-called missing gospels and lost gospels, the kind of stuff that goes on, say, like in a Gospel of Peter, for example, that just doesn't ring true to history, where you've got, you know, Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, coming out as a cross and things like that, which is clearly embellished kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Well, that's great. Well, at the end of the day, you know, if you were encouraging somebody, I mean, you've obviously studied and taught this for decades, and has your confidence, and as you've studied, you know the ins and outs, you know, is good or better than anybody. And so basically, I guess the question at the end of the day for students and people considering these claims is, can you trust the Bible? Can you trust what we have? Are you confident, and how would you kind of summarize that? I know there's a lot you could say.
You could certainly trust the core story of the Bible. There's no reason to have any questions about it whatsoever. You know, there are places here and there where people ask good and fair questions. I think there are explanations for them. I think there are comfortable places to land, if you will, in terms of trustworthiness. But I understand why people ask questions at certain points. And I think it's just important to distinguish that difference in answering a question like this. But the core answer is, the core story of the Bible, I think the disciples got right. I think the disciples understood their confession of Jesus as the Christ and ultimately as the Son of God. I think they got that right. I think that anyone who thinks that what we have is actually a reflection of a Jesus who taught that he was a that taught and taught his disciples to think of him only as a prophet, that would mean to get the core story wrong. I don't think that happened. I think they got the core story right.
That's excellent. That is really, really helpful. And is there anything else kind of you're working on? I know you've done recently, maybe another time perhaps we can get into Who is Jesus, your excellent recent book on that. Is there anything kind of you're working on these days that...
I'm working on a Gospel of Matthew right now for a commentary that actually will involve me being paired with a preacher. It'd be Vic Anderson, and he delivers sermons off of the exegesis. So I'm responsible for the exegetical part of that.
Oh, that's great. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that. And everyone, I'm going to have links to all of Dr. Bach's works. And again, they're so helpful. And there's, you know, commentaries and articles. He blogs, and I'll have links to his blog. You can follow him on faith and culture issues. Also, something exciting going through Dallas Seminary now is can you tell us a little bit about the table, the new podcast you guys are doing?
Yeah,
and how people might find
that? We're doing a weekly podcast called The Table Podcast. We're doing an annual conference here in Dallas called The Table Conference, be April 19th and 20th. That conference will be on the topic presenting God to those who see Christianity differently, trying to help people sort out the difference between a cultural Christianity and a biblical Christianity. So we're looking at questions like which Jesus, which Bible, which Christianity over a two-day period. Lee Strobel is probably the featured speaker that most people would recognize. But we're also doing podcasts on a variety of topics related to cultural engagement and how God and culture connect. Topics run all the way from cultural engagement in general to world religions. We'll be focusing on Islam here pretty soon. To issues of sexuality, we have Stan Jones, provost at Wheaton College, who's a psychologist, talking about how the church should think about through the issue of ministering to and interacting with the issue of homosexuality. We'll have discussions on sexuality in the family, how to raise your kids in relationship to those kinds of questions. Have three counselors in to talk to us about that. So it runs the gamut in terms of what gets covered. Some of it will be theological. We did a special chapel on the historical Adam, and we'll be doing some more focused podcasts on that. So we'll release a new piece every week. It runs anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes long. The podcast topics run an hour at a time, but we release them in pieces gradually, and eventually you get to the whole thing. And we'll be running through just a wide variety of topics on God and culture. You can get to it at www.dts.edu, and you can click for the Table Podcast, and that will take you directly to the podcast. You can subscribe, so you can get them automatically. They'll be available through iTunes and YouTube, so you can get them that way. So there are a variety of ways to get access to these. It's called The Table Podcast.
Outstanding. That's going to be an excellent resource, and that's exciting to hear basically that whole community and just engaging those issues, and it'll be a great resource for people to get. Highly encourage that. So, well, we're about out of time. So, Daryl, thank you so much for taking time to help us really think through these issues, writing that article, and really giving us some distinctions with which to approach the question of biblical contradictions.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, and all the best to you, Jonathan.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Think Christianly podcast, and I hope you have more confidence that you can trust the Bible. I just want to thank Daryl Bach again so much for his time and his expertise being with us. It was a real pleasure and a real treat for me personally. He was kind enough to forward my latest book, Think Christianly, Looking at the Intersection of Faith and Culture with Zondervan. And I've just learned so much from him through the years and just really appreciate his heart and his mind and his ability to translate and engage the culture well. So just so much encourage you to check out his website, his blog, his books, and you'll really profit from them. Well, at Think Christianly, we're all about helping a new generation understand what they believe, why they believe it, and why it matters. And just really want to encourage you to check out our website at thinkchristianly.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can like our page on Facebook. I hope you've had a chance to subscribe to our podcast through iTunes. and help us spread the word about it. And if you have any questions about the Christian faith and apologetics or worldview, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can use the contact form on our website, and we can maybe cover those in a future podcast or a future blog post. So we'd love to hear from you. And we want to invite you to partner with our ministry. And again, you can learn more about us and all that we're doing at thinkchristianly.org.
Think Christianly, because all of life is connected.